begins to quiet down the class as the mental exams. So it's graded, and so you can confirm from the website, we'll make the grade column go live at the end of this afternoon sometime. I'll hand the exams back, there's about 5 minutes left in the class. I'll tell you in detail what I think about the specific distribution and what you should take away from it, given your specific grade. It wasn't an incredibly unusual distribution for one of my exams, but I'll tell you more about it. The mean was about 60, so it's a tiny bit low. While I've got you here and while I have your attention and before you get distracted with the fact that I'm about to hand them back at the end of class, I wanted to sort of say a few things. One is, you know, the job actually isn't over if you're serious about class. You need to actually look through and understand the solution, and you need to look at what you missed. And if you're like me, when I'm done with the exam, when I was sitting where you were sitting, I never wanted to hear about it, see it, or think about it again. Okay? If you wanted to piss me off, you'd be one of those students who'd walk out of class and start talking about what you got for number 3. I would totally bolt. I didn't want to be anywhere near those people, okay? So good for you if you're like that, but I don't get it. At any rate, that said, I'm going to tell you, don't be like me. When you get your exam back, you need to look through it carefully. You need to look through the solutions carefully. And I don't care if you made a 20 or you made a 96. You can learn from that, okay? Learning is a piece of it because this material didn't go away. For some of you, you'll see it on the MCATs. For all of you, you'll see it on the final. Okay? So, and gel time is a real thing. I hope you'll find that when you go back, in fact, a number of the things you miss, you're going to go, you know, you'll be surprised. Another reason that I really want you to go through it is try as we might to grade everything appropriately. Mistakes do get made. Okay? I do spot check things. I spot check them. I spot check my TA's work in part because I need to know how to interpret the numbers in terms of what to tell you at the end of class today and how I think you're doing and what your take rate should be. So what do the numbers correspond to in terms of my vision of what it means to make an A or it means to make a B minus or whatever. Okay? But that means it just leaves you to have the inappropriate grade. And I really don't want to see people handing me regrades just because they missed something. And that does happen. I'm not going to regrade all your exams. But if you go through and you understand the solutions and you understand what you did, and you realize that what we're trying to do is to grade these problems in such a way that we more or less scale with your degree of understanding on that problem. So the partial credit is a very real thing. If you believe there was an egregious mistake, I have no problem looking at that. Okay? I don't want to negotiate with you. I don't want you to come up and start explaining to me what you did. You got to understand, that goes in one ear and out the other. No, it doesn't matter what you say, I'm not going to catch it. Or if I try to pay attention, I'll forget it in 30 seconds, just because I'm a ditz that way, alright? So what I ask of you, for you to do is simply take your exam, write clearly on the front of it what it is that you think I should look at in terms of a regrade, and then hand it to me or put it under my office door, okay? I will let that little pile grow for a week, okay? I'll give you some time to look at it, and then I'll go through them, and I'll make a judgment on each of those particular things, all right? I'll then make a grade change or not, and those exams will be then ready for you to pick up, and I'll notify you. And if at that point you think I'm wrong and you want to negotiate, well, it's no negotiation, you're welcome to come and discuss it with me, okay? But I want you to stop and think about what I said, all right? and then I'm happy to talk to you about it, but I don't really want to do it before then. And I really, really don't want to see a regrade come in where it's clear you don't understand the solution. All right, that's step one. So that's sort of the regrade policy. Well, that is the regrade policy. It is explicitly on the web, probably written out of date for some old class I did, but it really hasn't changed. So another old thing I realized is very often sort of at this stage of the class as people got their exams and they started asking me questions, I found that I was going through many of the same diagnostic questions to try to figure out what was working or not working for them on the exam. Okay? And at some point I had the bright idea of actually creating an online troubleshooting guide. Again, it's probably going to look out of date when you look at it, because I probably did this for some, you know, Physics 113 when we were carving things in stone. But that said, it's still the same set of questions. So if you look at your exam and you think that something could be better, that you want to try to see how to make it better, that is a place to start, is to go through and sort of go through the troubleshooting guide and see if it tells you anything. The other thing to do is to really think about it yourself, and then if at that point you want to chat with me, I'm very happy to chat with you, okay? I will tell you a common mistake that people make in this class, or 113, is they sort of blow off a bad grade in exam one. Oh, you know, I was a little tired. I had this athletic event, so I didn't study as much as I would have normally. And you make up an excuse, okay? And then exam two comes, and you're basically in the same spot. And you see, exam one, if you don't do as well as you want, it's your drop. There's no water under the bridge. Exam two things count. It's also later in the semester. So if you're going to fix something, now is the time. Every year, I don't know who it's going to be, probably they're not in this class at the moment, but every year I get at least one or two students who come to see me like 3 days or a day before the final exam, asking me what they can do to do well on the final exam because they've been making 20s on the exams or whatever. Okay? And there's nothing I can do with that. Even if I truly could get them to turn over a new leaf and their study habits or whatever, you can't do anything in 3 days. And so it really does happen. So the best predictor statistically for how you do on exam two is how you did on exam one. That said, it is by no means cast in stone, and I have seen people who did very poorly on an exam sort of change how they're studying, change their approach, put in more time, stop working with somebody who blurted out how to do the problem every time before they sat down to do them, so they never actually thought about how to interpret the problem. I mean, that makes a big difference. Lots of things can happen that can short-circuit your ability to sort of get it. And if you change those things, you're all smart. You wouldn't be here. You'll get it, and you'll do much better. Okay? So my message is, if your exam isn't what you want it to be, then now's the time to go through and think about your approach to the class and ponder what you should change in that approach for the next exam, or for now. Okay? So I'll get off my soapbox right now. If you do want to make an appointment with me to chat about how you're studying for the exam, etc., my best diagnostic is your exam. I can look at that very often. I can ask a few questions and figure out at least some things that might or might not help. And a lot of that is actually just written in the troubleshooting guide. But your exam is your best diagnostic for figuring out what's working and what's not. And, you know, I don't want to leave you with the feeling that you're all walking disasters. Many of you did very well on this exam, and you can just not worry about anything I just said. Okay? All right, so we'll talk more about that in the class. Now back to the fun. Last time we started talking about capacitors and capacitance. And the mental picture that you might carry in mind for a capacitor is that parallel plate geometry. And, you know, just bear in mind that it could be any set of things, okay? It could be a bunch of spheres out in space. It could be who knows what. Any system could have a capacitance. But this is a reasonable mental picture. And this picture is a very good mental picture, for example, included in a circuit, which is very often how you actually end up using it. So in a capacitor, if I put a capacitor across a fixed voltage, say, from a battery, then it will deposit charge here and here. There'll be a voltage across this, so there's an electric field in the middle. And it turns out that the amount of charge that gets stored here is proportional to the voltage. If I put a bigger voltage across here, there'll be more charge here. And that constant of proportionality turns out to depend on the geometry of this device. And it's fixed for that device. Okay, there's this linear proportionality. So we quantify that proportionality with this number called capacitance, which we measure in farads. What is a farad? A farad is a coulomb per a volt, which is work per meter. So that work per charge. Sorry. So this is coulombs per work per charge. That's coulomb squared per volt per joule. This picture is the parallel plate capacitor, just to give you a heads up. You know, I think I actually killed this slide and had a nicer one I liked up there. So this is my symbol for parallel plate. I'll often use it for shorthand. If I want to say something's perpendicular, I'll use this. And the geometry here, we actually derived this last time, is epsilon naught A over D, where A is basically the area of the capacitor. After class, somebody came up to me and asked, when I was talking about the area, did I mean the entire surface area here and around here, or was it just that surface area on the inside? And it was just the area on the inside. If you look at how we set up the Gaussian surface last time, it was just the area of the inside surface. Don't get thrown by the fact that I put the positives here and the negatives here. It's a conductor, so think of it as just basically spread out. If there's negative charges over here, these positives are going to be pulled onto the inside of that surface, if you will. But you have to have room to draw these things. So you'll find very often people will do this, or they'll just put a plus here and a minus here, or whatever. So you'll see different notations. That slide I was going to kill, I was going to use a prettier version, which is this slide. So I think it's all the same thing, though. Okay, so another thing we did at the end of class last time was to look at what happens if you have multiple capacitors in a system. And you'll find that any combination of capacitors can be broken down, maybe in stages, into groups of capacitors that will be either in parallel or in series. So parallel means that if I hook a voltage across these, they're all connected to the same voltage. Right? Series means if I hook a voltage across here, if I were a charge trying to work my way through the circuit, I have to hop through each of those capacitors, if you will. So I have to sort of go through each. We derived last time that if I put capacitors in parallel, so this geometry, that the capacitance of this total thing, if I were to put a shoebox around it and call it a single capacitor, that capacitance would be the sum of the capacitors that are inside. And if I had the situation where those capacitors were in parallel, then it turns out that the relationship we extracted last time in class is 1 over this total capacitance is equal to the sum of 1 over the individual capacitance. Physicists have a fondness for this word. It's a little bit obnoxious if you're not a physicist, but they'll say, actually, it's obnoxious if you are a physicist. This is sort of trivial. If you go to POA and some grad student and says, "Oh, this is just trivial," try not to slug them. okay? That's really part of their training, is to learn how to say things like that. They don't really mean to belittle you. It's just sort of part of the culture, I guess. Just think chill. On the scale of things, this isn't hard. You'll see integrals that you like a lot less. Okay, so this is pretty easy. You'll see when we do resistances in maybe next Tuesday, we'll derive the same sort of formulas for resistances. And what you'll find for resistances is if they're in parallel, you have a reciprocal relationship here. And if they're in series, you have them linear here. So it gets flipped. The pattern gets flipped. And that's the hard part. That's the thing that gets you confused. It's not that either one of them is difficult. It's just if you sort of get into a habit of doing one or the other, when, you know, you have to keep straight which of these sets you're talking about. And when I get to the resistances, I'll at least share with you how I keep it straight. Certainly you can put it on your formula sheet. I don't care, but you will want to keep that straight, because invariably one of you will pull out the wrong one on the exam and be pretty upset with yourself after the fact. But it's really not that bad. The other funny thing about this is, of course, you don't normally just see things in parallel or things in resistances. You'll see a mix of the two, and you have to sort of break it down into parallel and series pieces by stages. So you probably have some homework problems that you need to do with that this week, or a workshop problem. So you'll get used to that. All right, but let's practice it for just a moment. Well, suppose that I have three capacitors that are identical. And in the left-hand case, I hook them up in series. In the right-hand case, I hook them up in parallel. And I now put a voltage between A and B that's the same voltage in case one and case two. So what I'd like to know, what I'd like you to determine right now, is whether how the charge in case one, the total charge stored on the capacitors, compares to the total charge stored in case two. You have three choices. Okay, so I want you to commit A, B, or C. Close your eyes. Close your eyes. Everybody who thinks A, raise your hand. B, C. Wow, a lot of you have commitment issues. Okay, so 20% of you raised your hand for B, and almost none for A, and almost none for C. Hello? Okay. How would you figure it out? Voltage is the same. Q is equal to CV, where C is the combination. So you just figure out what is the C for the combination. And for the left-hand side, you have 1 over C is equal to 1 over C sub I. So that's equal to 3 over C. So that's C total, 3 over C sub I. So the C total is equal to C, the little C's up here, over 3. And then on the parallel side, the C total is equal to the sum of the C sub I's. So C total is equal to 3
C. So the capacitance is biggest if you're over here. Q is equal to CV. If V is the same, capacitance is bigger, so you'll have more charge over here. So 2 is bigger than 1. Okay? Intuitively, you might think, well, why would that be? Remember, what's happening here is I'm dumping some charge on this side of this capacitor. It then induces charge on the other surface, which then gives you charge on this side, which induces charge here, which gives you charge on that side. And if you want, sort of induces charge here, you're dumping the same here. So in a sense, you're taking a certain amount of charge, and then you're inducing things over here, but you're not really spreading more new charge over out in that field. Here, you're sort of allowed, you have each of these capacitors with that same voltage across it, and you're dumping charge on each of them, so you have more surface area to spread it out on. The other thing here is this voltage, remember that's work per unit charge to go from A to B. That means you have a voltage drop here, here, and here. So the voltage across each of those capacitors is less than the total voltage from A to B. So it's each of these is going to have less charge on it than each of those will have, because the voltage across each is less. So lots of different ways to think about it. You okay with that?
So I would like to look at a very important question, and that is how much work, or if you want to think about it this way, the energy does it take to charge a capacitor. What do I mean by charging a capacitor?
I have capacitors sitting there, it's just plates. Think of it as just metal plates, all right? Now I hook a battery across each of those plates. There's a voltage across them. Charge is going to flow onto those plates until the voltage across those plates is the same as that across the battery. And then no more charge will flow. And at that point, you have a charge that's on that capacitor, and that charge is going to be equal to CV for whatever that capacitor is, the CV that it has. So there's actually a process where the charge gets put on there. And so the question that I want to ask is how much energy does it take to do that?
And we called the whole process just charging a capacitor. So imagine that I have a battery with a voltage hooked to a wire which goes to a capacitor. And imagine that we are at T equals zero. So
we're still sort of talking about electrostatics, but I'm going to sort of allow things to evolve in time a little bit in spite of that for a moment. At T equals zero, so the very instant that I put the wires on the capacitor, there's no charge on that capacitor.
And then if you want to think of it this way, what happens at that point is because, you know, I have a big positive charge here, a big negative charge here, the charge sort of begins to flow. So at some given point, say at T equal sometime T1 later, then I'll begin to build up the charge here. So I'll have some DQ prime that is building up on this capacitor. All right. So to examine this and
if you want to think about it, initially I have no charge over here, so it doesn't really take me any work to move the charge to that point. That's pretty easy to do. As I build up a lot of charge over here, then you can imagine it starts to be a little bit harder for this battery to push the charge over this way, because you now already have some positive charge here. That process is going to get harder and harder until you reach the equilibrium where this is at the same voltage as that. If it's at the same voltage as that, then it's basically like the same piece. But so in the dynamic system, imagine that you have, if you want to calculate how much work it takes to fully charge this, imagine taking little bits of charge and moving them over, and it's going to be harder and harder if you want to think about it as you build up charge on the other piece.
So that means if we want to talk about how much work it takes, we sort of need to think about it in a continuous sense. So let's imagine for a moment that I'm at some intermediate time and I have a little dq prime that I am moving across. And at that moment in time, I have fixed here a q prime and a v prime. And you might think, wait a minute,
it's a conductor, so how can I have a v prime? This V prime is the potential across this capacitive plate, and I guess I'm telling you it takes a moment for you to build that up. You have to transfer charge before the potential across the plates here is exactly what it is over there.
And remember that we have the relationship, which is always going to be true, which is Q prime is equal to the capacitance times V prime.
So as I build up the charge and I reach some Q prime, there will be a potential difference across this capacitor, which is this V prime, and that depends on the capacitance itself. Okay.
So a way to think about this V prime is
if I were to take a piece of charge from this point, this V prime you could call it the amount of work it takes to move this charge per unit charge over to that plate. Okay?
So the amount of work it takes to move that little Q prime over is going to be equal to V prime times dq, or V prime dq prime, or V prime is equal to the amount of work it takes to per unit charge over on the plate. So the amount of work it takes to move that little piece of charge is equal to Q prime over C, because I just rewrite V prime, times dq prime. So that would be basically the relationship for how much work it takes to move a little tiny bit of charge somewhere in the middle of this process. And now I have sort of relationship in terms of how much work it takes for that little bit and how it depends on the charge itself in terms of how the charge is going up. So now what I can do is to integrate over both of these sides and calculate the total work it takes to move each of the little charges. As I go from zero charge up to the total charge that I'll have on the capacitor. And that's the answer that we're after. How much energy does it take? How much work does it take to put the total charge on the capacitor? So this work is equal to 1 over C is a constant. This is C as in a capacitance. And then this integral becomes Q prime. Well, prime is the variable, so we now just turn it into Q. It becomes Q squared over 2, evaluated between 0 and big Q, which is 1/2 times Q over C. Q squared, sorry. Q over C is V. So this is 1/2. Q over C is V. 1/2 CV. Q is equal to CV. So this becomes 1/2 times C squared V squared over C, so this is 1/2 CV squared. And I can also rewrite it by getting rid of the C, and C is equal to Q over V, so I can rewrite this as 1/2 Q squared times Q, divided by Q over V. If I did that right. So you can look at this work say that the energy it takes to charge a capacitor but if you've done that, that energy is sitting in the capacitor. So you could also say this is the energy stored in the capacitor. And that's going to be 1/2 CV squared or Q squared over 2C or 1/2 QV. You can write it any of those three ways depending on what variables you have. You okay with that? Very often this symbol is given as U, which is often a symbol used for potential energy. So if you want to think about this as potential energy stored in the past. Any questions? Any thoughts? Okay, so if this is boring you enormously, just stay tuned. I'll bore you more. No. We're actually leading up to something very profound. Honest, we are. So if we imagine we have a charged capacitor, I mean, this is basically what a capacitor is. And I've just told you that somehow we're storing a bunch of energy. So where does that energy reside? I haven't coiled a spring. I haven't shoved a kid up to the top of a sliding board. But I've done something. I'm storing energy. So where is this energy stored? You don't have a lot of choices. When we have an uncharged capacitor, there is no electric field in that state. When I charge a capacitor, I have a big electric field there. So you could think that maybe the energy is stored in the electric field
of the capacitor. And that's
a little bit of a statement, because if you recall way back when we first pulled the electric field out of thin air, we did exactly that. We sort of went, let's make up this thing. Okay? And now I'm about to tell you this thing if it contains energy, you can store energy in it. You can move energy around with it and everything. It becomes really, really important. And
makes you begin to wonder whether there might be some reality to it. So, if we assume for the moment that the energy is stored in the electric field, then we might be able to actually figure out what is the energy density that is in an electric field. And I'm going to use a symbol U, and sometimes I'll put a little E here. That's going to be the energy stored in the capacitor divided by the volume between the parallel plates. We know all about capacitors now if we use this parallel plate model, and we know how much energy is stored there. So let's see if we can extract the energy in the energy density of the electric field. The energy density is equal to the total energy divided by the volume between the plates. The total energy is 1/2 times CV squared. The volume between the plates is going to be the area of the plates times the distance between them. If you recall, way back when, we calculated that the capacitance C for a parallel plate system is equal to epsilon naught times A over D. So I can substitute that in. So the energy density is equal to 1/2 times epsilon naught times A over D times V squared over A times D. Which is equal to 1/2. The A's cancel. I have an epsilon naught, and I have a V squared over D squared. For a parallel plate, where I've separated these, there's a voltage difference between the two, and there's a distance D between them. And I have an electric field here, E. The amount of work it takes, the amount of work it takes to move a charge from one plate to the other is Q times E. Which would be the force times the distance, which is D. And that then is equal to the voltage I pull that voltage per unit charge voltages, I'm sorry, that's work. That's the Q. This, okay. So this would be work. If I pull the Q down here, then this becomes the voltage. So the electric field is equal to the voltage across the plates divided by D. In other words, this
is equal to 1 half times epsilon naught times the magnitude of E squared. So what we find is that the energy density of the electric field is equal to epsilon naught over 2 times the magnitude of the electric field squared. And that actually is a bit of a profound statement.
And notice that I used a very particular geometry to extract this. But there's nothing about that geometry in this. All I'm saying is, in space, if there is an electric field, there's an energy density in that space that depends on the magnitude, the square of the magnitude of that electric field, according to this relationship. Electric fields carry energy. So if I have a system and I have no electric field in it, and I start shoving charge around until I create an electric field in there, you can say that you are storing energy in that electric field. Okay?
Any questions?
All right. So what I have here is power supply and a voltmeter up above it. The power supply basically supplies charge across three capacitors that are connected in parallel. This is a voltmeter which measures how what the voltage is across the capacitors. So right now it measures zero, so that's what you see up at the top here. Okay. So if I decide to charge them up, then what happens is you see that the voltage in the power supply becomes effectively the voltage across the capacitor. Okay? So in principle, they now are charged. I'll now remove the power supply. Okay, but you'll note the voltage still is across the capacitors because they now store the charge. So there's an electric field here. And let's just try to discharge them if I have things hooked up right, which I might not. Try this. Now I'm short across the face of the capacitor. So you heard the spark. And when I did, the voltage dropped to zero. All right, so all I've done is I've taken the capacitor and allowed the two plates to touch each other so the charge just evens out and you get the spark that was jumping across. Okay. So now we're going to do the same thing. It happens fast, so now they're charged up. Okay. And now what I'm going to do, instead of discharging across this thing where you heard the spark, I'm going to discharge across a resistive wire. Resistive wire means it's something that inhibits the flow of the charge a little bit. So the charge basically hits nuclei in the wire and deposits some of the energy as it tries to flow through in terms of heat. Okay? And so when it does that, it can be fairly dramatic. Now we have them charged, okay, so now I'm going to throw the switch, and when I do, it's going to discharge now through this bolt. He said, something wrong here. So
didn't discharge. Why did I not discharge? I didn't discharge because...
The way it's set up is the discharge will happen when I do this. Okay, so now you're going to hear the spark, but it's also going to discharge the coil.
No!
Alright?
Yes.
So think about that next time you plug your little Instamatic camera. That little battery in there is just charging up a little capacitor, and you flip the switch, and it discharges through a little resistor, and poof, you get your flash. That's what it is. But the point is, hello, can you see me? I'm actually giving you all the finger. Okay, so...
Interesting how long this lasts.
Energy. You heard sound, you saw light. Okay, you saw a spark. And what we did was we simply threw a bunch of charge on these two plates, big plates, in weird shapes, no doubt. Probably some weird materials in there. We'll talk about that later. But really effectively, just two big plates. And we let it sit there. That's where the energy is. And then we let that energy do something. So that's sort of cool. That energy was stored in the form of an electric field. You okay? All right, so regardless of the geometry, if you have a system that has electric fields, it's fair for you to ponder what is the energy in that electric field, or the energy stored in the system. So let's suppose I have two conducting shells. And let's say that I just put a plus Q on the inside shell and a minus Q on the outside shell. And I could ask you, what is the total energy stored in this system? Okay, that's a legitimate, reasonable question to ask. You may not give a crap, but I might ask you the question, so you're going to have to know how to solve it anyway. All right, so if you look at this, you know, after you get over your shock and look at it, okay. Where is the energy stored? If this system has an electric field in it, it will be stored in the electric field. So the next step is to figure out what is the electric field in this system. If I know what the electric field is in the system, I know what the energy density is in an electric field, so I can take that electric field and basically integrate the energy density over that volume, and that gives me a total energy. So in this system, I hope by now, you look at this and you think, okay, if the charge is on the conductor at radius A, and I have the other conductor at radius B, so I have a plus Q on radius A, minus Q at radius B. I hope by now you've done enough of these problems, you look at this and go, all right, I know that inside radius A,
there is no charge. Therefore, Gauss's law, if I drew a Gaussian sphere surface, a Gaussian sphere, I would have zero electric field. So there is no electric field inside of radius B. If I go outside of radius B, so that's outside both of these spheres, the total charge enclosed again is zero. So there will be no electric field outside. Okay, so you don't need to worry about that either place.
So to do this problem, I mean, and if I gave it to you on exam, systematically go through, think about each region as if it were just the Gauss's law problem. Once you have the electric field, then we'll worry about the next step. The first step is to get the electric field. So at this stage, it would be okay not to use Gauss's law. If you've done enough of these problems, you can look at it and say there's no charge inside, therefore E is zero. There's no charge enclosed total outside, therefore E is zero. So you could give me an answer that says, you know, for R less than A, E equals zero because there's no charge enclosed in a Gaussian surface. For R greater than B, E is equal to zero because the net charge enclosed equals zero. Okay, so that's fine. So then we need to know what is the electric field in the interior region. So you can draw a Gaussian surface in this interior region. Say it has a radius r, little r. So for A less than r less than B, then the integral of E dot dA is equal to Q enclosed over epsilon naught. Inside that pink sphere, the charge that is enclosed, in this case it all resides at R equal A, is just plus Q. So the right-hand side is just plus Q over epsilon naught. The left-hand side, it's a spherically symmetric problem, so E dot dA becomes E times dA. dA is 4 pi r squared. So this becomes E times 4 pi r squared. So that means that the electric field in that region is equal to Q over 4 pi epsilon naught r squared. And at this point, you might look at that and go, that is exactly the same field I would have if I had a point charge of magnitude plus Q at the origin. Many of you, I hope, having studied for this last exam and everything, would look, have already looked at it and known that, right? Because if I have a spherically symmetric thing with plus Q inside, the field from the outside looks just like that of a point charge. Okay? And that would have been okay. You wouldn't have had to do this step. You could have said that in words if you want. Anyway, having done all this, in this system, even though it looks sort of complex, what we have is an electric field that is enclosed inside this region, and within that region, it falls off as 1 over r squared. It depends only on this charge, big Q. So if I now ask you to calculate how much energy is stored in the system, then what you would like to do is to take this volume, if you will, and multiply it by the energy density in the electric field. So energy volume density times volume gives you energy, and you're good. The catch here is that the energy density depends on the electric field, and the electric field strength depends on where you are in this volume. It grows as you go out in R. So you can't just take the volume that's in here and multiply it by some constant, because that isn't the constant. It's changing with R. Okay? So you have no choice but to try to integrate it. So to get E, the energy total, you basically want to take the energy density and multiply it by the volume, and that'll give you the total energy, okay? But there's a problem that you have, which is that you have a dependence on R. All right, so you have to think of it in little slices of R where you can figure out what it is. So the way to do it is you imagine that you have a thin shell here. Which has a thickness dr. It's at some radius r, okay? It's arbitrarily between these two shells. And if I want to know what is the energy there, the differential energy, actually instead of E here because I'm using this mu, let me say du for energy. The differential energy in that thin shell is going to be equal to the volume of that shell, which is going to be the area of that shell, 4 pi r squared times its thickness, 4 pi r squared out a little distance dr. That would be the volume of the shell times the energy density of the electric field at that radius. And you say, wait a minute, how do I do that? The energy density depends on where I am in R, because it's 1 over R squared. Over this tiny little slice in R, I choose the slice to be so thin that the energy density can be thought of as a constant across that little dr. So this is a constant across that little dr, if you want to think of it that way. So I can write volume times ue there. So this is, I'll rewrite it a little bit. UE is 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught, 1 over r squared, that's q over r squared. Okay, that's not it. That's the electric field squared times epsilon naught over 2 gives me UE. So the electric field squared times epsilon naught over 2 is the energy density. That didn't work. And that gets multiplied by the 4 pi r squared dr. And that would be the differential amount of energy that's stored in that little thin shell of thickness dr. And now to get the total energy, I take all the little possible shells ranging from the radius of A out to the radius of B, and I add them up. And they're very, very small. So this is an infinite limit, an infinite number of shells. That's what we mean when we talk about an integral. So now we integrate the two sides. The left-hand side is U, that's the total energy. And the right-hand side, 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught, is, those are all constants, those pull out. Q squared pulls out. The other epsilon naught over 2 pulls out. The other 4 pi pulls out. And I have, looks like I have a 1 over r squared dr, and I'm integrating that from A to B. And having done all that, let's see, this cancels that, these cancel that. So I get a q squared over 2 times this integral. Okay, so the integral, I dropped something. No, that's okay. So the integral of r to the minus 2 is r to the minus 1 over r to the minus 1. So this would be q squared over 2 times minus 1 over r evaluated between the limits of a and b. Or u is equal to drop the K somewhere. Yeah, I think that's it. I did not square that. So this part gets squared, so only one of them gets canceled. So this is a 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught down here, if that's the case. And then I get a q squared over 2, and then I have 1 over a minus 1 over b. And that, then, is the total energy that you would have stored in that particular system.
Okay.
So you can see that, unfortunately, you're not allowed to forget the old stuff. So sometimes people ask me, you know, why do you make your exams cumulative? And it's a little bit like, well, I can't help it,
because it all just sort of builds up. It's like you're not really allowed to forget most of what you learned in 113, because it all builds up. So the energy is stored in the electric field. So electric fields in a vacuum are important, and later in the semester we'll talk about an example which is extraordinarily important of that nature. But in many instances, electric fields and materials are actually very important. In fact, I would say for this class, electric fields and materials is probably more important, because if you want to understand chemistry, you're talking about electric fields in materials. If you want to understand biology, if you want to understand what's going on in a cell membrane or with a nerve or anything like that, you're talking about charges separated in solutions and materials and stuff. So if you want to talk about the capacitance of a nerve, it's going to have crud in it. CRUD is a scientific biological term, if you're not aware of it. So what happens with an electric field when you have CRUD in there of various sorts? So that is a very important question. And so I hope at this stage you've had this one just shoved up your nose, right? When you're trying to do chemistry and you're asking how do things operate in the chemical world, how often are you sitting there going, well, polar or non-polar? Right? If you want to know if these things are miscible, you need to tell me. It's polar or non-polar. Right? It's everything in chemistry, whether something is polar or non-polar. So we're going to talk about sort of those two extremes here as well. So you can imagine. So we're sort of looking at now electric fields in materials. And you might ask, what happens if I have different types of materials? So one type of material might be polar, and the other type of material might be non-polar. So you can sort of imagine, you know, the standard non-polar thing might be carbon tet. But let's just, for example, imagine I have a positive charge with sort of a negative charge density that's evenly spread around it. And let's imagine a polar material as something which is made up of a random mix of sort of natural dipoles.
And so in a given mix of material, whatever it is, you'll have these dipoles, but you have thermal things happening. They're moving around. So you pretty much imagine that they have random orientations. If I have a nonpolar stuff, I have this nonpolar thing more or less sitting there. And there may be some vibrations and stuff, but more or less it's going to be nonpolar. What I mean by that is you don't really have a net separation of charge. Okay? So imagine what happens if I now take these materials and I put a big electric field across it, or a small electric field, or whatever. If I have a little bit of an electric field happening in a polar material, okay, if I have a plus charge here and a minus charge here in my elbow, okay, plus up here, and I have an electric field this way, it's going to move this plus this way, the minus is going to get moved that way, it's going to act to cause a torque on this thing, which means these little dipoles are going to begin to align along the electric field. And when that happens, you'll begin to get a net separation sort of within the material itself. For the nonpolar material, you'll have a little bit of force on the positive charge that'll push it one way, a little bit of force on the negative charge that pushes it the other way, and you'll begin to form a little net dipole in the nonpolar material. And so those will now, they'll, by virtue of what's happening in them, be lined up with the electric field as well. Okay? So that's telling me it's time to do the exam. So what happens is that in a material, you'll begin to get either deformed nonpolar things that will begin to line up, or polar things that begin to line up. And what we'll look at next time is what will happen is that will actually weaken the electric field in the material itself. Okay? And the more easily it is aligned, the more weak that electric field will become. The degree of alignment will depend on the strength of the electric field. And this will depend on the material itself. So what happens with the electric field in the material very much depends on the material itself. And so we'll talk more about that. One of the materials you want to consider in biology is water, for example. So anything that's happening around cells and water, this is going to be pretty important stuff. All right. Okay, so here's the distribution of the exam. Great. The mean was 60. That actually, in and of itself, is not that unusual for my exams. And I apologize for it. I told you it's usual to feel like you got hit by a truck a little bit, because you can be on the means, really do okay, and still lost a lot of points. That said, I looked over a lot of these very carefully before I came to class. And so I have a little bit of interpretation. Very often with my exams, I'm pretty comfortable putting a B right at the mean. With this exam, I'm a little less so. And the reason was, when I spot checked 10 or 15 grades around somewhere right in here, I saw that they were actually, lots of the students were missing things that were pretty egregious things. Like, in the first problem where we have charges in different distributions, they weren't actually using the electric field of forces as a vector. That's like week one of Physics 113. So I started looking at that, and so what I found was that I was seeing some pretty major holes right here. So I'm sort of thinking for this test, the B minus line is somewhere pretty close to here, just for your thinking, all right? Found if I was looking up around 70s, there might be a hole and some mistake, but basically they're doing okay. Alright, so that one I was pretty comfortable with being pretty good in the B range. So that is pretty solid. Clearly up here things are going very well. Alright. Don't bother asking me, do I have an A minus or an A or a C minus or a C plus? I don't even think about it to say. That's not what's important. What's important is the takeaway that you're getting here, all right? The takeaway is, if you did pretty well on this exam, don't change anything. But by that, I mean don't let up, because it's not like the next exam is going to seem any easier, okay? If you're in here or whatever,
things are going pretty well, look at it carefully. Ask yourself, do I have a hole? Or am I making some silly mistakes? Those are sort of different messages for you personally, as to think about how to correct your holes if you have a hole that you shouldn't have had. Or if you're making silly mistakes, literally think a little bit about test taking, and maybe we can work on ways to eliminate some mistakes. If you're down in here, when I look at it, there are lots of holes and things where I think you should have gotten it, where I think you had practice, we did things. I don't think this exam was that far out there. So you need to look at it and ask yourself, what's going right, what's going wrong, what can I change if I want to do better? Okay? And so that's the takeaway in this. And like I say, now's the time to make any changes if you're planning to do it. Before I hand these out, does anybody have any questions about what I'm saying here, or regrades, or anything like that? Okay.
Looks like some instrument. Like it seems like most people don't have like these joints working well.
I wish I could.
Do you play any instruments?
No, I've never even really tried. I spent 20 minutes trying to learn how to play the flute because my sister had a flute.
Okay.
It's funny.